Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Coming up on episode 204 of Wheel Bearings, we talk about the Volkswagen ID.4 First Edition, the 2022 Volkswagen Taos, the 2022 Honda Civic Sedan, and in the news, we cover the Peugeot 9X8 Le Mans Hypercar, Rimas taking over control of Bugatti, Stellantis' EV Day, a little more discussion about BMW's new EVs, the i4 and the iX, and we answer some listener questions. All coming up next. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. This is episode 204 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abual Samage from Guidehouse Insights.
I am Nicole Wakelin, and this week we'll go with Kelly Blue Book.
I am Roberto Baldwin, and let's say Engadget.
All right. So, let's start with you, Robbie. What have you been driving this week?
So, I actually didn't drive this week. I drove this a few weeks ago, and I haven't talked about it. I haven't had a chance to put my video up. But the new Volkswagen Taos, the 2022 Volkswagen, it is their entry-level vehicle. It essentially, I guess it sort of replaces the Golf TSI. You know, you can only get the GTI and the Type R Golf here in the United States anymore. So I drove this on a drive program a few weeks ago, and what's nice about this vehicle is that it starts at about with destination, et cetera, $24,000 for a nice Volkswagen compact SUV. And so it's an entry-level vehicle, which I don't think there are enough of right now out in the world. And entry-level vehicles or like first cars like this, they're hugely important, I think, for a lot of people. Because if you're young and this is your first new car, like this is the car you might have the longest out of all your cars. My second car was the longest I had, which was my first car was a 69 Datsun 2000 Roadster. And then I bought a 90 Honda Civic because I wanted to actually be able to get to my destinations that are further than 10 miles from my house. The Roadster was great, but I wanted to go places. But I had that Honda for 15 years. I had other cars, and I kept that Honda because it was my first entry-level car. And you make so many memories in these vehicles. These are sort of like you live and you work and you do schoolwork in these things. And it's sort of insane how expensive cars have gotten that we don't have more sort of inexpensive, good cars. And I feel like the Volkswagen Taos is an inexpensive, good car. I drove it around, I only drove it for the day. But yeah, it was comfortable. You could do it for long drives. It has enough space for you and your friends. You can throw your stuff in the back. And whether this is your first new car or you need a second car or you're buying a car for your kid, a lot of people want to buy a car for their kid, going off to college or maybe they're in high school. And as, cars get more and more safe, they get safer as time progresses, they feel a little iffy about buying a used car. I mean, the Taos, it's a great entry-level little vehicle, and I really enjoyed it, and I do wish there were more options for folks out there who need something that doesn't cost the median price of, what is it now, $40,000? It was $35,000, and now it's gone up to $40,000.
It's about $40,000, yeah. And actually, last week when the automakers released their June sales reports, in Ford's sales report, they actually touted the fact that in June, their average transaction price was over $47,000.
Wow.
$47,000.
And part of that is because they part of that's because they've discontinued all their affordable cars.
I say they got rid of everything that cheapest, like a kid would buy, like all the kid, all the graduated college cars.
The cheapest
are gone.
Thing they, the cheapest thing they have right now is the Escape, which starts around $24,000 or $25,000, and goes up from there, until the Maverick shows up later this fall, that's going to start at $20,000. They're going to have these elevated prices because there's just nothing affordable from Ford.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there is this sort of dead zone right now in the entry level world where you have very few options, and there's a ton of thirties, and up vehicles, and that's why the median price is sort of gone crazy high. But a lot of people are still trying to find work after, post COVID. And not everyone can afford. It's hard for me to wrap my head around buying something that's going to be $35,000. And I make, my wife and I do pretty well. We do live in the Bay Area, so you have to adjust your
after your housing costs go up, you're basically living in poverty.
Yeah, if we lived anywhere else in the United States, we'd be doing great. But we live in the Bay Area, so the cost of living is higher. But we get paid, Bay Area money, so it sort of evens out, maybe. But yeah, it's really difficult for a lot of people to look and say, okay, I want to get a new car, and then they get sucked into these 5-year lease, 5-year, payment plans, which is, gosh, that's insane, unless you can get it like zero API, and even then you're fighting against the depreciation. You're like, well, I hope that what I'm paying I'm not underwater on a car, which is sort of crazy. But
yeah, well, especially if something happens to it, if you get in a crash or it gets stolen or something, and suddenly you find that you owe more on the car than it's worth, and the insurance company is only going to give you what its market value is. Although right now you're probably okay because the market value of used cars has gone up so much for the time, for right now, for a little while at least, you're okay.
For right now, unless you own a 2004 Jaguar X-Type, I looked the Carvana price because someone had talked to me about their Carvana was giving them more money than they anticipated. So I threw the car, our Jaguar X-Type, our free car, on Carvana, and they offered me $270. So if you're looking for a cheap car, the Jaguar X-Type, a 2004, well, just the Jaguar X-Type is out there if you can find one, and you don't mind all the check engine lights being on, all the time.
We just got a better offer on the car we just traded now that was probably about $4,000 more than what we had were offered for it 3-4 years ago, and 3-4 years ago, way less mileage and way less things that were wrong with it. I'm like, I don't know how this exactly worked, but okay, sure.
Yeah, no, it's. I'm sorry. Go on, Sam.
I was just gonna say, last night I was talking to my friend that I bought my Miata from 4 years ago, and he said, whatever you do, don't sell that car, because he's been looking for another one to buy, and. He couldn't. I think the cheapest one that he's found, that's relatively low mileage, first or second generation Miata is like $12,000 or $13,000, which is substantially more than I paid him for that 1990 4 years ago. So, so I got a question for you. We've had over the last year, a couple of years, we've had several of these entry level crossovers come into the marketplace, the Nissan Kicks, the Hyundai Venue, there's a couple others out there, and they typically start, around $19,000-$20,000. I think the Kicks still starts at about 19. Is, this one, 24 with delivery, is that, is it like $3,000-$4,000 more? Do you think it's worth that much more than those vehicles?
I like the Kicks a lot, and I like the Venue. I think the Nissan Kicks is probably the best car that Nissan's building right now. even with before the refresh, where the door panel inside was just like almost a flat piece of plastic. It's just like this flat, just shape. They're like, we need something to cover the innards of the door. Shape hole for the handle. I do think it does feel a bit more solid than the Kicks and the Venue. Well, it does feel more solid than the Kicks. The Venue, that might be a toss-up. I'm trying to remember when I drove the Venue. It's, you know, Hyundai's been, you know, Hyundai's inexpensive vehicles are still, you know, they're doing a great job. They're top-notch. So I think the, you know, I think if you were looking for an inexpensive car, those are the three you should check out, for, you know, because everyone wants a compact SUV. I mean, the reality is that you should look at Golfs and actual cars for me, but I understand the market, I understand what people want. And people, you know, if you're looking for an entry-level car, I would drive all three. I think the Golf's premium price tag is warranted for the most part. I think it feels a bit more solid. It feels a bit more like a car that's worth that extra cash. But at the end of the day, that's really on the individual. And I would try all three and see what your budget allows. If you are really sort of, if it's tough, it's a tough call. I think you're going to be fine with the Kicks or the Venue. I think you're going to be happy with, without spending that extra money. If you do have the extra money, you know, the Golf might, you know, stepping up to the Golf might be pretty cool.
You mean the Taos?
I'm sorry, the Taos, not the Golf. Sorry, I got Golf on the brain.
What? Okay. Taos. How, for a different comparison, what about the Mazda CX-30, which starts at $22,000, so with delivery $23,000. So it's about $1,000 less base price than the Taos.
I haven't driven the CX-30. Do you think yet. But based on Mazda's, you know, track record, oof, that's a toughie. Because I feel like the Mazda's probably going to be a bit more fun to drive. So I think if you're a driving enthusiast as opposed to a person who just drives to get, you know, who just needs a car to get from point A to point B, the Mazda's probably going to be the better choice. If you like a touchscreen versus that weird thing that Mazda has, then
yeah, I mean, obviously for Nicole, the Mazda would be a non-starter.
Right, exactly.
I think it wouldn't even be under consideration.
And I think Mazda's like, hey, we're not using the touchscreen is. In theory, a good idea, but I think at the end of the day, most people are still plugging in their phones, and their phone, you know, if they're using CarPlay or Android Auto, it's kind of a pain in the ass to use those systems without an actual touchscreen, because it's actually taking your eyes off the road more, because now you're like sort of like trying to navigate and figure out like where is the little selector going to go next as I try to like pick a song, or as opposed to just like, okay, I know if I just stab in this general direction, it's gonna be okay. And I definitely do not think touchscreens are the end all bee's knees, because a lot of times I sort of have to put my hand on top of the screen and then tap with like my thumb if the road's
to brace it,
or,
yeah
to sort of brace it, so my hand isn't bouncing all over the place and I'm hitting all the wrong buttons in order just to do something. And you know, they should be augmented with, you know, next song and volume control, and everything else should be an actual physical button, but I'll stop on that sort of weird tirade. If you're a driver, if you're, I Mazda is probably going to be the better option. If you're looking for something that's a bit more, you know, you can't live without, you know, Google Maps, Waze, except Apple Maps for some whatever weird reason, if you can't live without those, maybe the Volkswagen will probably be a better match for you.
Okay. All righty. What about you, Nicole? What have you been driving?
I am driving the all-new 2022 Honda Civic Sedan in the strangest color. Okay, you guys both have to look up this color because it's the weirdest color. It's called Lunar Silver. And it basically is like this super weird pale blue thing that everybody who's seen it is like, what's that color? Like, I don't know why. It's not... It feels like a car color my grandma would drive. I don't like it. But aside from the very weird color that does nothing for the car, move on to more important stuff. But don't get Lunar Silver. It's not an attractive color. It's great. I mean, it's a Honda. It has that quality interior. It's never overly fancy and overly done. It just has exactly what it needs to be comfortable and useful. I have the Touring, which is their top trim, and it also comes with the 1.5-liter turbocharged engine. That's 180 horsepower and it has a CVT. It's more than enough to get this moving. I mean, it's easy to accelerate onto the highway. You never feel like it's struggling to keep up, and it's really quiet. I CVTs, you know, they still can produce a noisy ride, especially when you're heavy on the accelerator. This was not. And it also handled really well. And it, although it's not wintertime, so you can't see what it's going to do when the snow falls. We've had some torrential rain here lately, and I made the mistake of planning to go out to dinner just as we got like, hunker down, tornadoes, wind, rain, floods, don't go out. And I'm like, well, that doesn't help me halfway to dinner. And it was dumping, and there was just water everywhere, really heavy rain buffeting the car and wind, and it handled beautifully. I was actually really impressed. It was a point where I thought to myself, okay, if it was snowing, I would feel pretty confident driving this car. I felt like it handled really well. It's plenty roomy. I mean, my husband is 6'3". He pushes the seat back, so normally only someone who's exceptionally small can sit behind him. But no, you can still sit behind him in this and not feel like your knees are you know, squished up against the back of the seat. It has a good sized trunk and it has good features. There's not a lot to complain about other than the color. And it comes with good standard safety. You know, this one has like leather seats and a Bose audio system. It has a 9-inch color touchscreen. Thank you, Honda, that I liked. So, I mean, overall.
And a volume knob.
And a volume knob. Yes, it has a volume knob. So overall, I it's a good offering. I mean, this is what I think the 11th generation of the Civic sedan. So it's been around for a while and it's seen a lot of changes over the years. And I feel like they continue to iterate it. They make improvements. It's nothing dramatic. It's not like you suddenly get into the Civic and think, oh my gosh, holy new vehicle. I'd never know, you know, this was the Civic. It's completely changed. It just moves it forward in a good and sort of predictable, but a good way. You know, adding a little bit of features, adding a little bit of style, adding a little bit of everything. And it's not the pricing. You were talking about pricing on cars. Now this is the top Civic trim that you can get. And it comes in at $28,300. So, you know, it's not exactly affordable. It's not cheap, but it's also not crazy expensive. And if you wanted to forgo, you know, leather seats and some of the fancy, you can get it for a good chunk less. I think the base models, you'll probably save a good, you know, couple of $1,000s. So depending on what you're going to buy, you can get into an affordable, comfortable, spacious sedan that's not going to break the bank. So if someone's looking for a sedan, talking about first-time buyers, the Civic is not a bad choice.
Yeah, I mean, we have a 2017 Civic, so that's the previous generation. And, you know, this one, you know, looking at the interior, it does look a little more upscale than ours, mm-hmm. you know. And that base price on the LX, you know, 21.7, so 22.7, you know, with delivery, I think it's certainly, you know, it's more affordable than the Taos, you know, starting point. And, you know, Honda, I think last year or the year before, they made their Honda Sensing package with all the ADAS stuff, standard equipment. So you get, you know, even on the base, you know, version of the Civic, you get radar, adaptive cruise control, lane keeping assist, and, also blind spot monitoring. So I think that's, you know, having all that stuff on there, you know, even at that base price, I think is a pretty good value.
It does make it a value, you know, I just got a new car. And one of the things I thought I was going to be paying more for my insurance, our old car was a 2015 and my insurance dropped significantly. And I'm like, how did my insurance, what was it? She's like, it's because there's so much standard safety on the car you just bought compared to the car you had. It actually brought down it's like $40 a month that it brought down my insurance costs. It wasn't insignificant. Cause I had that moment of like, wait, what? Are you sure we got this right? But she's like, no, it's because of the safety. And it's not like we were driving a car with nothing before, but just that change from what you think was available 4 or 5 years ago standard, there wasn't a heck of a lot. What's standard now? That's a big difference. And it's enough to, you know, save you a few bucks and help make your insurance a bit more affordable too. And you don't have to pay extra to get those things you mentioned, Sam. It's going to be there whether you decide to go with the top trim or the very bottom. You're going to get that safety.
I've owned two Honda Civics, a 90 and a 94, and both of them were virtually, not even virtually, essentially bulletproof. You could do anything to those things. And whenever you get into a Honda, as soon as you're just closing the door, you're like, oh yeah, This is Honda quality. This is what you're at. So I feel like that money spent on that Civic, even the trim level, you're probably going to be like, okay, this is going to be around for a while. And yeah, adding the sensing, the Honda sensing as standard. I think everyone adding more and more of these things as standard is so incredibly important. I mean, it's nice when you have adaptive cruise control when you're stuck in traffic. But it's nicer when you have the, you know, auto stopping when you're about to smash into somebody or whatnot. And those are huge, huge safety gains for a lot of people.
Yeah, and there is what you're saying about like shutting the door and you're like, okay, this is a Honda. There is a solidity to this. You know, it's a small, it's a compact car. It's a sedan. It's not a huge vehicle. And sometimes, like when you're talking about the kicks and the door on the inside of the kicks, you know, the door trim, it had that really like, oh, good Lord. Like it felt its price, let's say. It felt cheap. It felt like you were trying to save money. This doesn't feel cheap. It doesn't, you know, it, like I said, 28 grand. It's not an outrageously priced vehicle, but it feels solid. It feels secure. It's got a nice quiet ride. You don't get that sense at all that like, okay, I'm in some kind of cheapo compact car that I'm just driving because I want great fuel economy. No, you get the sense that you bought something that's quality, that's going to be around for a while. We've had two Civics, both of them when there was a Civic hybrid, and it was when gas prices were just outrageous. And they both were driving perfectly fine when we decided to turn them in. And we had two kids who beat up the car like you wouldn't believe. They are hard on interiors. They drove a wheelbarrow into the outside of it at one point. But nope, car's like, that's fine. I have a big dent in my door now, but I am ready. Like it just... they just keep going and they don't start to feel their age. Like they really hold up really well. So if you want to get a car and you want to hold on to it, go get yourself a Honda. You're going to have it until you're just sick of it.
Until you're like, well, I want something different.
I just want something different. I can't drive this anymore.
That's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping that my wife doesn't get sick of it for a long time. So I don't have to make any more car payments for a while. So far, it's doing great. You know,
good.
4 years, a little over 4 years, and it's doing great. So, can't complain. And I did my driver's ed in a Honda Civic back in the early '80s, an '81 Civic with a four-speed manual, a little hatchback. Yeah, it was great.
Nice.
I love those.
It was a tiny little car.
So small. I love those. I feel like I'm a Honda fanboy, even though I don't own a Honda at this point. Those old, especially the old ones, they were like little weird little golf carts. Like it was just like with these fun little transmissions, and I would just, my dad brought my sister and brother an early '80s Honda Accord, which was just slightly bigger than the Civic, and they didn't want to work on it. They didn't want to do anything with it. It just needed a starter. So every once in a while, my dad would ask me to drive it around, start it up, drive it around, and just keep the battery charged. And I absolutely adored that car. And my sister and brother, you're in high school. They wanted to be cool, and it was the '90s and an early '80s Honda Civic or Honda Accord wasn't cool. But man, I'm sort of sad the day my dad sold that thing.
I didn't think of it until you guys started talking. We've had two Civics. We had a CRV back in the day, and we had, and I know this car was like, they didn't even last very long, but we had a Honda Element. We loved that thing.
Oh, yeah.
That was brilliant when you had kids because the doors opened in such a way that you could always get to them in the back.
The rear hinged half doors.
Oh, my gosh. You could sit in the back and you could like sit there and use that space. And when kids made a mess, as kids do, you're like, break out the hose. Whoosh. I loved that thing. They marketed it sort of towards like, this is for the outdoorsy type who's going to put a bike in the back. I'm like, oh, heck no. This is for the parents who have kids who drop food and get sick and make a mess and have snow and all sorts of junk on their boots. Oh, man, I loved that car. We only traded it because the fuel economy was atrocious, and that's when we got the hybrid Civic instead.
Yeah. They're sort of – my brother still owns one, and he has told – I have made him promise me – that if he ever sells it, I get rights of first refusal.
That's a good promise.
Absolutely. And there's one on my block, like across the street and two houses down, they have an Element, and I'm just waiting for them to put it on sale. Because it's the perfect, like you could throw we have the dogs, I have my bands, I have all my art projects that I'm working on. I have to go to Home Depot and get mulch, of course.
Does everything.
All that. My friend, her sister sold hers because it was gutless, and I'm like, that's not what that's about.
No, that's not why you bought the Element. I wish they still had an Element. I love that.
You know, if it's gutless, you know, you just go find a used VTEC engine and drop it in there.
There you go.
Yeah, then those are like super cheap, at least at the time. I haven't looked. I haven't researched VTEC engines in a while, but I remember you could just buy them for like $400, and we'd swap them over the weekend. it was nuts, crazy times.
Yeah. All right. Well, I too had a Volkswagen crossover. Actually, I still have it because this was supposed to be picked up 2 days ago, but the Genesis GV80 that they were bringing to me on Tuesday got a flat tire on the way here, and they had to take it back to the shop. And they've been waiting to get a new tire, and I still haven't heard back from Drive Shop about when I'm going to get it. So anyway, I've got the Volkswagen ID4. Which is the first of VW's purpose-built EVs for the North American market. They launched the ID3 last September, I think, in Europe. And then late in the year, they launched the ID4, which is basically the same vehicle, but slightly taller, slightly, you know, more crossover-ish looking. Although I've got it parked right now next to a 2015 Kia Rio in the driveway. And it actually doesn't look much bigger than the Kia on the outside. But on the inside, I mean, it feels huge because you've got that flat floor. You know, it's an EV. You know, I'm 5'11". And if I get, you know, set seat where I want and get in this behind me, you know, I have like several inches of knee clearance in the back. So, I mean, there's a lot of room in this thing. It's really good to drive. I mean, it drives like a Volkswagen, which is what you expect, and even more so in most respects, because the default for VW's MEB electric platform is rear-wheel drive. So rear motor, and then they're going to have dual motor all-wheel drive versions as well, but they haven't launched that yet for the ID4. This one that I've got is the first edition, which is now sold out, It goes for $44,000. And the main distinction between the first edition and the other ones is the white steering wheel and instrument pod and bezel around the center display. But you know, other than that, you know, it's basically the same. It's you know, fairly loaded. Because it's only a single motor, it's only 201 horsepower, and you know, it's a fairly hefty vehicle, actually, even with, you know, in single motor rear drive configuration. It's almost 4,500 pounds, which for a vehicle that's, you know, got a comparatively compact footprint seems like a lot. And, you know, compared to some other crossovers of similar size, it's quite a bit heavier. But the torque, the instant torque of the electric motor makes up for a lot of that. It doesn't feel nearly as quick as something like the Polestar 2, which has two motors and twice the power, but you know, it's still quite more than acceptable. You know, got really good drivability. The only real complaint I have about the driving dynamics is the steering doesn't really have any feedback. It feels kind of dead, although the effort is fine. It just doesn't really give you any feedback when you're going around corners. But it's roomy. It's great to drive. I like the way it looks. I like the new design language that VW is applying to their EVs, with the signature lighting they've got on the ID3 and the ID4, and it's going to be on some, you know, the other ones they've got coming out. And I like, you know, this one is the blue with the silver trim around the greenhouse, you know, which is, I think it's a nice two-tone combination. It's got the full glass roof, which is, you know, I prefer to drive, you know, with the sunroof open if it had one, but it's, you know, it's fixed in place, but that's fine. The two main complaints with this thing, there's no front trunk. I think you can make the case for it in the case of the MEB, because when you look at the proportions, it's got a very short front end. They moved the base of the windshield forward, and even though there's no engine in there, it's a fairly short front end, and they pack in all the climate control and the power electronics and other stuff in there. So there's not really room in there for storage. But, you know, there is an extra, like, deep little storage area in the back under the rear cargo area where you can throw the charging cable. So I can get by without the front trunk because there's a big cargo area in the back. The other main complaint about this thing is the infotainment system and primarily the software performance of the infotainment system. The user interface is fine. It's fairly standard modern user interface, you know, grid of 8 icons, and it's a good size screen. I think it's a 10-inch screen. So nice big touch targets, fairly easy to hit. Although even, you know, when you're driving on bumpy roads, you know, same thing as you were talking about, Robbie, earlier, you know, trying to hit the touch targets, trying to brace, brace my hand, to hit the touch targets. But, that is what it is. But the responsiveness of the system is not great. Sometimes it's fine. And the thing is, it's inconsistent. Sometimes it responds fine. A lot of the time it's kind of sluggish. Sometimes it does some weird things, like there's no volume knob. There's capacitive controls for to get into the climate control and the volume and adjust the temperatures. And the volume control is centered just below the screen. And, there's basically two areas where you tap one, on the right to raise the volume, on the left to lower the volume. Every once in a while, it will randomly, when I go to change the volume, instead of bringing up the audio volume, it brings up the voice operation volume, which I'm not even sure what that is. And so I'm trying to change the volume, and it's just not responding properly. And it also takes quite a long time to boot up when you first get in the car. To get to a point where you can actually do anything with the screen takes a while. VW does have over-the-air software update capability for this thing. And they just put out a release a couple of days ago, actually, that they're going to start pushing out OTA updates to the ID vehicles, starting with vehicles in Europe. And so hopefully they'll have some updates to the infotainment software soon that improve the performance and the reliability of it. It did kind of hang up completely on me a couple times where it just didn't respond to anything at all. Aside from that, the rest of the driving experience was good. I drove around for several days. When I first got it, I got it fully charged up, drove it for several days, drove about 230 miles, and still had 25 miles of range left showing before I went to the EA station and charged it up, and got from 7% state of charge to 85% in about 30 minutes. It's rated 125 kilowatts charging capability. It was doing 123, 124 until it got to about 40 or 50% and then started tapering off. So you can charge it fairly quickly. It does have support for plug and charge. When I went to the EA station, the first charger I plugged it into, it refused to authenticate. So I moved over to the one next to it, plugged it in, boom, worked fine. It authenticated, just started charging. I didn't have to tap, do anything with the credit cards or anything. VW is giving you 3 years of free DC fast charging with the ID4. Now that the first editions are sold out, they're selling the ID4 Pro as the first regular model. Those are starting at $40,000, and then you get the $7,500 tax credit on that. And I think there's supposed to be a shorter range, smaller battery version coming later on, as well as a dual motor all-wheel drive version. So you'll probably have options between with sticker prices between about $35,000 and $45,000 by probably the first part of next year. Overall, I like it. Hopefully they'll do something soon about the software. Prior to the launch of the ID3, the launch was actually delayed for several months last year in Europe. Apparently it was primarily because of software issues. And VW is doing a lot of this stuff in-house, which a lot of automakers are starting to do. And I think they still have some learning to do about developing a lot of the software in-house. There's still a lot of challenges. If you're looking for an EV, this is one I would definitely take a look at. Although, if you can wait, a few more months, you might also want to hold off and look at the Hyundai Ioniq 5, which I don't think any of us have tried yet, but you know, it's a similar size vehicle. And it potentially has some advantages over this one, like even faster charging. It's got 350 kilowatt charging capability, you know, a little bit different styling direction for that one. So there's a lot more options coming. But if you know, if you're looking for an EV right now, if you can find an ID.4 at a Volkswagen dealer, which I haven't looked at the VW dealer yet to see what their inventories are like, but if it's anything like other automakers right now, it could be a problem to actually get your hands on one. But it's definitely worth a look.
I've only ever seen one, like, on the road here, as you're saying. I feel like I need to drive by my local Volkswagen dealership, but I've literally seen one.
I did a video for Tom's Guide. I think the review's coming out this week for the vehicle. But we were at an EA station, and a person who just bought the ID.4, it was her first time charging while I was at the station. I was like, oh, this is what you need, because there's an issue where the if you're trying to authenticate and it doesn't, the charge hose at the cable, there you go, not
cable
hose.
Charge hose.
I'm like, not hose.
I'm gonna call it a charge hose. Well, from now on,
charge
how
hose.
Long is the charge hose?
It's flowing.
It's a hose through which electrons flow.
Yeah, the electron hose. The electron hose got she couldn't detach it, and you have to like unlock the car. Even if the car's unlocked, you have to unlock it again, so it keeps people from sort of like coming up to your car and unlock and pulling the the electron hose out of your vehicle. And I've seen more and more of them on the road. I've seen more Mach-E's on the road recently than I've seen ID.4s. But it is sort of, you know, but again, I live in the Bay Area, so that's you know, you got to take that into account, because we're all hippies up here. I really like the ID.4. And again, the latency on that infotainment system. And like you said, sometimes it's fine. And sometimes you're just like, oh, I just don't even want to deal with this. I'm just like, what is happening? Yeah. Why is this? Like, you're just like pushing, you're like, oh, forget it. And you just like plug in your phone. And then I use, you know, CarPlay or whatever. And because I'm just like, all right, I've tested this enough to know that things are not going as well as it should be.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to my friend Stephanie Brindley about a month or so ago when she had it. And you know, she had just gotten it the day before, and she was telling me that, you know, it's like she couldn't, there was no start stop button, you know, and when she got out of the car, you know, the radio, you know, the audio would keep playing until you get up off the seat. You know, it was using the sensor in the seat. And when you put it in park and you get out, that's when it turns off the audio system. Mm-hmm. And I didn't talk to her after that, but a couple of days later, she found the start stop button. And it was the same thing with me. You know, a couple of days after I had it, I was looking from the passenger side, and I realized that it's actually on the side of the steering column where you'll never see it. So you don't actually have to turn it on and off. You know, when you put it in park and you get out, it'll turn everything off. And when you lock the doors, you know, it'll be shut off. But that's the other thing. When you lock the doors, most cars, when you lock the doors, you know, it gives you a little beep of the horn to let you know that it's responded. Nothing, no sound from the ID.4. It just locks.
There's
know,
not like a setting where you can make it beep at you, like somewhere buried.
Not that I could find.
No, okay.
It's all
there. Probably is somewhere in the software, but I couldn't find it.
By time, yeah, that off on button is great if you're shooting video, because I would get up and we would want like the lights on or whatever to like do something while we're shooting video, so you could see the light. And you'd get up and you're like, okay, we got to turn on the car, and I'm like, it's a whole, and I was like, trying to explain to the videographer, I'm like, it's a whole thing. Like, usually you get out and the car just turns off. He's like, well, how do you, I'm like, fortunately there's a button here so we can turn this on. But yeah, if you don't know it's there, it's sort of, it's there in the column, and it's sort of hidden, and it's only, I guess for if you're shooting video.
I guess. I mean, maybe, you know, if things go completely haywire with the software, maybe there's probably some sequence with that you have to use to reboot the thing, but something like that.
Tap it three times and then do the contra code on the steering wheel, up, up, down, down, left, right, left, right. Select start, AB 1, 1, 2, 3, tap, spin around. There you go.
And, you know, the controls on the steering wheel are interesting too, because they're capacitive touch buttons on there. But there's haptic feedback, so it's like using, you know, an iPhone 7 or 8 that has the home button that doesn't actually move, mm-hmm. or a modern MacBook, with a touchpad that doesn't actually move. So when you click it, it gives you haptic feedback that simulates that it's clicking, but it's not actually moving.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with the buttons on the steering wheel on this thing. So it takes a little getting used to.
I have a question about that. Did you find you ever hit it by accident? I can't remember which vehicle I had that had haptic buttons, and it would just feel like I was the touch buttons. They were I'd be turning the wheel, I've accidentally swiped my finger, and I have now cranked the volume to 12 as I'm trying to turn, and now I can't crank it back down because I'm in the middle of turning the car. Did you find that you didn't hit them by accident?
No. No, because it's more like if you've driven a recent Audi with a touchscreen, they have haptic feedback in the touchscreen, so you actually have to press it. So it's not like just tapping on your phone screen it's actually looking for a bit of pressure.
Got it.
So it's kind of more like the 3D touch on an iPhone.
Yeah, because that was my big complaint the one time I had it. It was just so easy. Like, you know, you're just driving and you slide your hand down the steering wheel and your fingertips brush against something. You're like, I didn't mean to change anything. Just repositioning my hands, folks. Leave everything alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's not a problem because, like I said, you do have to give it a little bit of pressure before it actually responds. So.
Thing about the ID.4 is I do appreciate the the first edition is 250 miles, but I felt like during regular driving, just regular, not testing it, not like doing, 0 to 60 tests or whatever, but like regular days when I was just driving it, you could probably get like 260 out of that thing if you were just sort of like cruising around town, VW group is doing. I think they're sort of underreporting their range. Probably for good reason, because the whole reason they're super into EVs right now is because of, a little thing we all like to call Dieselgate. But I think the whole VW group sort of push for it. It's 250, but they come up and whisper to you, it's really 260.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I got, I did 230, and stopped at the charger, and it was showing 25 miles left on there. And most probably 2/3 to 3/4 of that was actually highway driving, because I had to go to Detroit a couple of times. So it was highway driving, and that's you're going to do worse on the highway with an EV because of the aero. I think, getting as long as it's not, too hot, and you have to use the air conditioning too much. But even that, I was using the AC, and, I think in ideal conditions, you can easily get, I think, 275 out of it, if you're not being too aggressive with your driving, if it's mostly around town driving. I guess that is the one other thing I would complain about a little. For the shift, it's got this big thing on the side of the instrument cluster. You twist it forward at the top to select drive and twist it, back to select reverse and push it in to get neutral. If you push it forward twice, you can go from drive to B, to braking mode. That's where you get your higher regen, but the regen's not as aggressive as say on the Mustang or, on a Nissan Leaf or on a BMW i3 when you're using one pedal driving. So it won't actually bring the car to a complete stop. And I've come to really like, strong regen. So I would prefer an option to have a little bit stronger regen, but it's, it's not there right now on this vehicle.
Yeah. I think the one pedal driving, and it's fun to, I will say, tell people this, it is fun to gauge how well one pedal driving works and how many intersections it takes for you to come to a stop right at the line. And I think for all the vehicles that are out there right now, I think the Polestar 2 does it best. And I'm saying that because on the first intersection, on the second intersection, I was able to come to a stop right on the line.
I remember trying that for the very first time in the Nissan Leaf. And they're like, you just this one pedal driving. And I'm like, okay. And I stopped 8 feet back. I'm like, boom. Oh, wait, that was okay. I get how this works. The next intersection, I'm like, must actually brake. Okay, this is, I can't figure this out.
It takes a little time.
Well, then you get it like, I get how this works. Yeah.
You gotta learn that feel for it. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I drove a car with strong regen like that was the Mini E, the original, the pilot program Mini E's that they built back in 2008. And at the LA Auto Show, they were doing some drives with it. And, you know, I pulled out of the garage at the LA Convention Center. And the first time I took my foot off the accelerator, it's like, whoa, you know, I wasn't expecting that level of decel with it because it was so aggressive. But, you know, within a few intersections, you know, I kind of had the feel for it. All right, let's do some news.
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 So Peugeot, part of the Stellantis group, this week unveiled their new race car that they're going to take to Le Mans next year. It's part of the new Le Mans hypercar class. And, you know, it's a hybrid, like, you know, many of these modern prototypes are. But it looks really different from most modern prototype race cars. Have you had a chance to take a look at the photos of this thing?
It looks very fancy.
It looks fantastic. It looks like a futuristic car in a video game. When you're playing, you know, some sort of
like something out of Gran Turismo.
Yeah, like the next generation crazy supercar. This is the car.
What is up with those taillights? Are they literally just like pieces that stick out, like
blades?
Little wings?
They're little stabby bits.
They're like little stabby bits. I'm trying to get. I don't think they have a close up of those, but they're like little stabby bits.
No, they don't. They only have a few photos of it. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you know, for those that haven't seen it, and we'll include the pictures in the show notes, but it's kind of like on current generation Mustangs, you know, where they have the three, sort of the blade, three-dimensional taillights, but only more so. They're much larger and thinner.
They really stick out.
You know, they look like three blades on each side. And I'll be curious to see how well those hold up on the racetrack, you know, when they're fender to fender, you know, racing. see how durable those are. But the really unique thing about this, do you notice anything that appears to be missing from this car compared to most modern race cars?
A hella large wing. There is no big giant wing attached to the back. The Peugeot says, hey, we figured it out. We don't need a giant wing. We can do
it
without it.
We don't need no stinking wing.
We have aerodynamics on our side without a wing. So we'll see.
But you know, when you look at it, there's that one thing that's like the totally just head-on angle, and it's funny the way those little side pieces go that run along the body. It looks like there's a wing when you look from the front. You can totally see how the design worked.
Oh, yeah,
like it totally looks like it until you look at the side or the back. Look at those fancy like engineers with the aerodynamic knowledge and stuff.
A lot of time in the wind tunnel and doing CFD simulations with this thing. You know, the rules for the hypercar class, you know, there's some things that they're very specific about. Like they significantly restrict what they call the lift to drag ratio, you know, so how much downforce you can get versus how much aerodynamic drag the body has. And it's limited to like 4 to 1. And so if you look at the other hypercars so far, like the Toyota and the Glickenhaus that are out there, they both still have big wings, but because these things are designed to run at Le Mans, where they've got these really long straights, you know, really high speeds, they're set up for relatively low drag. And I think, you know, Peugeot figured out that they could generate enough downforce just from the underbody of this thing that they could get by without a wing. And, you know, we'll see, you know, late this year when they actually start testing it on the track. This is just a mock-up, photos of a mock-up that they've released this week. But I hope that they, you know, that this thing actually works, because I would love to see something so different running in this. There's going to be some interesting stuff coming to the hypercar class over the next couple of years. Ferrari's joining this class, and, there's some others. I'm just glad to see somebody doing something creative, and hopefully this one works better than the last really creative Le Mans prototype, which was the Nissan GTR Nismo back in 2015. I don't know if either of you remember that one. It was a pretty wild looking car. No, I think you're thinking of the Mercedes CLR from the late 90s. They got airborne a few times, and they finally withdrew them from the race. The Nissan was this. It was unlike most modern race cars. It was front engine. It was actually front wheel drive, and had a really unique aerodynamic concept. It was meant to be a hybrid, but they never got the hybrid system working right. So it had really big front tires and really skinny rear tires. It was really hyper-optimized for Le Mans. You know, and then the bodywork, you know, had these channels for the air to flow through. So it would put down, you know, all the power through the front wheels, and it was supposed to be really low drag and, you know, similar to this in terms of generating downforce with the body. But the hybrid system didn't work, and it was a complete disaster at Le Mans. And like 3 weeks after the race, Nissan pulled the plug on the whole program. And instead of continuing to develop it, they just said, forget it. We're done.
Wow.
And it was has never been seen since.
That's a lot of money to be like.
I was gonna say, that's a lot of money. It must have been so horrifically bad. They're like, we spent a ton of money. Oh no, we'd have to spend a ton more. Done.
Yeah. Like, yeah, let's just make a regular car. Let's make the Kicks instead.
Well, they Nissan. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, here's the. I'll drop it in the Slack here so you can see it. It's definitely a unique car. Got a very different look from any other modern Le Mans prototype.
Look at the wing on that thing.
All right.
But, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got a wing. It's got a wing, all right. All right. Back to EVs. Remas, the little Croatian startup that has garnered some attention in recent years for some crazy fast electric supercars. Matej Rimas, the founder and CEO, they have taken control of Bugatti from Volkswagen. They basically, Volkswagen handed it to him and said, here, you take it.
And, you know, we don't want this. You take it. I'm not going to try it.
Bugatti, while they have created some pretty amazing cars over the last 20 years, really only two cars. They've only had two main models, the Veyron and the Chiron, the current one. It's often referred to as Ferdinand PX Folly because he bought the rights to the Bugatti name in the late 90s when he was still CEO of Volkswagen, and wanted to build the ultimate car. And I think what's a Chiron go for now? I think base price is something like $2.5 million. Yeah.
$1 million.
Times.
Yeah.
2.5.
Yeah. I think the Veyron, I think over about a 9-year production run, I think they built 450 of them. I think 300 coupes and 150 convertibles. And they're currently doing the Chiron. So what they did was they set up a joint venture between Porsche and Rimas, with Rimas owning 55% of the joint venture and Porsche owns 45%. And that joint venture company, Volkswagen just handed over control, just transferred the shares of Bugatti to this new joint venture. So Rimas has control. So it's going to be interesting. What do you think that Rimas might do with Bugatti?
In the press, there were interviews and they were saying, we're not going to just go out and make an electric Bugatti, and we're not going to make, we're still going to have a gas powered Bugatti out, coming, and we're still going to have an EV Rimas, but I think in the future, they're going to have something interesting. I think it's Bugatti as part of the Volkswagen group was always kind of, you understood why it was there, but at the same time, it was just so I don't know. It's such a niche automaker for Volkswagen to own, and they already have a performance brand. They already have Porsche. And so having Bugatti was always just like, hey, by the way, we also...
And Lamborghini.
And Lamborghini, yeah. And like, oh, sorry. And Lamborghini. Sorry, Lamborghini. but, they have two performance brands, and one is a supercar maker, and then they have Bugatti, which is making supercars for not just the ultra-rich, but the incredibly insane ultra-rich. I've been offered a chance to drive a Bugatti a few times, and each time it hasn't worked out. But also each time the idea of driving something that's worth, like... more than the entire block where I live is worth is insane. So I can see why, they were sort of shopping it around, and I think there was rumors for a while that Remas was going to pick them up. And I think this is a better fit. Because it's two brands that are just sort of in two insane brands with like a performance brand as like kind of a base in there with Porsche. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they have in about 10 years. I think it's going to be a while before we see something like really just where they merge both companies into one, I don't know, $7 billion car.
Yeah, because it's not like these are companies that are pumping out like new cars every, we have seven different models in our lineup and it's been 3 years and it's time for a refresh and 3 years and time for an all new. There's such a long time frame and so few vehicles, it has to take a while before we really see them mesh together into one giant, expensive, crazy car.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Bugatti's averaged something like 50 cars a year that they build. So it's definitely very small numbers. So, and I think they're planning to build about the same number of Chirons that they did Veyrons. So, it's still got quite a few years left in its product cycle. So maybe by the time the Chiron's done, maybe they'll think of something to do with the brand.
Something with an on at the end. The Ion. The yeah. Ion. I'm going to call it. The next Bugatti's
going to
be called an Ion. Or the electric Bugatti's going to be called the Ion. There, I'm done.
Is that too close to Ionic?
No.
I mean, because people could easily get confused between whatever the Bugatti would
That's
be
true.
And your typical Hyundai.
Yeah, Ionic 5. Somebody going into a Bugatti dealer with the intention of buying an Ionic 5 and ends up with an Ion. Yeah.
Surprise.
Ooh, yeah.
This is a lot more
than
I anticipated.
$4 million, please.
All right, sure, I'll buy it.
I thought they said this was $40,000, not $4 million.
Well, dealer markups, man. They're crazy.
They're cray-cray.
Yeah. All right. Last night, as we're recording, I went to Detroit. BMW held another event like the one you went to in L.A. A few weeks ago, and they had the i4 and the iX there. That's a lot of grill on both of those cars that doesn't do anything.
It is a lot of, they said they put sensors behind them, but you don't need that grill for those sensors. It's not like the sensors are the size of the size of a Nissan Versa. How's that? You need sensors the size of a Nissan Versa. That's how big the grills are.
The size of an entire Versa. Yeah.
But I think the thing that surprised me more is when I realized, and I hadn't realized this before when I was reading about it, both of these cars have proportions not altogether different from other BMWs, which means they have a fairly long hood, the cabin is set back, and it's got that kind of sporty vehicle proportion to them, but neither of them has a front trunk despite having a really long hood. And in fact, on the iX, turns out you can't even open the hood. There is no release for the hood.
Is there
the
even like? Does it look like
the hood
there's a hood
is for the dealer to do it?
So
there's a cut line there and everything. So there is a hood, but the owner cannot open it. You have to take it to a dealer. So basically, it's just for service access to stuff and to the motor, the front motor, and the.
So they don't
the
want you to ever touch it. Like, do not touch this. We have sealed it. You may not go in here. Out.
Well, it's like the i8. You couldn't open the i8 either. Hood on the i8, but it's fun.
That's true.
You,
but I mean, that was also that was
IX,
a much shorter front end.
That's true. On the iX, when you want to put a washer fluid in, the logo, the BMW logo, like pops up.
Yeah.
And you pour it in there. Someone's going to try to put gas
little,
in there. Someone. There's going to be a story.
Oh.
Someone's going to
totally.
Borrow their friend's iX. They can't figure out where to put gas, and they're going to put it in that thing, and then the windshield's going to catch fire.
Aside from the grill, I think the i4 actually looks really good. I'm not crazy about the iX. I think it's a little weird looking. But the i4 looks good. So
the profile of the i4 is really nice.
As long as you approach it from the back or the side, I think it's great.
Like,
just don't ever walk up to it from the front.
And then they don't need, and you know, they just unveiled the new 2 Series without a manual transmission. Boo! But the grill on the front of that thing is really small. Like, I was like, okay, BMW will not back down on the grill, but for some reason on the 2 Series, they're like, we don't need a big grill on this car. Maybe because it would have eaten the whole car. Who knows?
It would just be a grill. True, yeah. No windshield. It goes right up in the windshield. You can only see through from one direction because it's grilled. It goes all the way up.
Just fold it right into the hood.
You know, right over the top, goes back down around the back of the car.
You can call them diffusers. Once they hit the back of the car, it's diffusers. Was that the extension of the grill? No, they're diffusers once they get over the C-pillar.
Once they cross the midpoint.
Yeah. Once you hit the B-pillar, it's a diffuser. Is that how?
All right. We got one final EV item today, and that's this morning. Stellantis held their EV day that they had been promising for a while and released some more information. Either of you have a chance to look at what they talked about?
I'm looking now. I am reading through the giant press release.
You know, it's fun because I like the direction Stellantis and, you know, is going, because of all the automakers, I think FCA has never encountered an emission standard that it didn't hate. You know, they were just like, no, we're putting big giant engines. They're like, oh, we're gonna have these emissions. No, these are horrible. And you know, even the Fiat 500e, I mean, they were losing a lot of money on that. They were like, I think they were saying they were like $14,000, but that was the best Fiat, the 500e. And they were telling you, the CEO actually said, don't buy this car, please do not buy this car because I'm losing money. And I'm sure he probably said it with an Italian accent. And I'm not going to try that because that seems offensive. But, I like the idea that the Stellantis, which, you know, Fiat, Peugeot got married and came up with the name that you would find in Greek mythology. They're coming.
Or in a pharmaceutical ad.
Ooh, the new Stellantis.
It just sounds like a drug. I'm sorry. No matter how much I try to get by it, I can't.
Stellantis may cause diarrhea.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah. Check to see if Stellantis is right for you.
Don't use Stellantis if you're on it.
See? It's so easy for us to riff on this, you know?
Oh, okay. Now I can't. Now I can't get away from it. But, you know, the name Stellantis, you know, they have four platforms that are coming up. One of them is a frame platform, so you can do body on frames, which means you can get a truck where you can swap out the bed for, you know, whatever weird thing you want to put back there, which is sort of exciting for the trucking industry. They have a, you know, a Ram 1500 coming. They got a lot of news coming out, and they're spending a ton of money before 2025. I for one applaud
$36 billion.
That's a lot.
That's like four Veyrons. And so they do have a bunch of really weird like sort of catchphrases for each brand. But
I was waiting for that because first of all, they have 14 brands now, which I don't think I'd ever counted. 14 brands in the company, and they've got 14 different electrified taglines, and some of these are okay and some of these are a little bit weird. I like the Jeep one, zero emission freedom. That's kind of cool with their whole freedom.
I mean that fits with Jeep.
I feel like that works for Jeep.
And Dodge, tear up the streets, not the planet.
Woo! Take that, streets. Of course.
Yeah,
but then it gets really weird. Like Abarth was heating up people, not the planet.
I don't get that. Is it like they now what?
Cooking.
Chrysler's
cooking
good,
people.
Chrysler's good. Clean technology for a new generation of families. Okay, Chrysler. I'll go all with right. that one. I like the Chrysler. I like the Jeep. What's Fiat? It's only green when it's green for all. What?
I don't even know what that means.
What does that mean? Does everyone get a free Fiat that so that we're all green? I don't. Does everyone want a free Fiat? I don't think so. I don't understand.
Fiat's going to be all electric. I mean, that's all we know.
Mm-hmm.
There's some. Yeah, and Maserati is pretty lame. The best in performance luxury electrified.
What is the Alfa Romeo thing? Did they elaborate on that? From 2024, Alfa Alfa E Romeo.
Yeah, they only talked about six of the brands in any with any specifics. Alfa wasn't one of them. Neither was Maserati. They're going to be talking more about them later. But you know, for the U.S., you know, they did talk about Dodge, Ram, and Jeep. So Dodge is finally going to get a new car in 2024. And Tim Kuniskis, who's the head of the Dodge brand, said, Dodge is not going to sell electric cars. It's selling electric e-muscle. So they're sticking with the muscle car theme, but they're going to use, electricity to get you there. And so they're launching an electric muscle car in 2024. And they gave, a vague glimpse of something that may or may not be, that car. I think one of the interesting details on there, did you happen to notice the logo on that car in the center of the grill? This little sort of triangle type logo. It's the Dodge logo that was introduced in 1955 and it was used through the 1960s and into the early 70s. Hasn't been seen for a long time. It's interesting that they're kind of going back to that logo. So there's going to be, we don't know if it's going to be a replacement for the Charger or the Challenger or both, or what, what else they're going to do, just that there's going to be at least, their first EV is coming in 3 years and it's going to be an electric muscle car. And they, during the section of the presentation where they talked about technology, they talked about the Stella large platform, which is what Dodge is going to use, will be capable of up to 0 to 60 in as little as 2 seconds. So they're clearly going after Tesla. I guess they're tired of Challenger demons being blown away at the drag strip by Model S plaids, I guess.
But would you rather have a Challenger demon or a Model S plaid? Which would you rather have, regardless of what it does at the track?
Oh man, that's a tough one.
You mean a current demon,
current
or
right now,
like a future electric demon?
A current demon.
That's hard.
Depends.
Because I don't want either, really.
If it's something I have to...
You don't want... No, you have to pick one, Robbie.
I know. I'm going to say...
If it's something I have to drive every day, probably go for the Tesla.
Yeah, if I can... And then I would get an aftermarket steering wheel. If I just need to get an aftermarket steering wheel...
Yeah, a real steering wheel.
Yeah, I'll go with the Tesla.
But you'd have to change the steering wheel. If you can't rip it apart, you have to drive it just like it comes from the OEM.
Oh, man.
Oh, then it's got to be the demon.
Yeah.
I can't deal with that steering wheel.
It's not safe. It's unsafe.
In case anyone thinks the interiors of cars don't matter, these guys just pick their car like, no, steering wheel sucks. I'm out. And that's the deciding factor.
It's not even just sucks. It's unsafe. It's the opposite of, it's more than just, it sucks. It's bad.
Okay.
Anyway,
thank you.
Yeah, there we go.
So, Robbie, you were talking about the body on frame, the Stella frame platform, and that's going to be the basis for Ram 1500 electric, which is coming in 2024, which is obviously later than the F-150 Lightning or the Silverado electric. But they talked about, our competitors are going to be there first with an electric truck, but we're going to be the best. And they talked about a range of up to 500 miles. A big thing they talked about was, focusing on efficiency, getting the most miles per kilowatt hour out of their EVs. So we'll see if they can actually achieve that and if they can come up with something better than what their competitors are doing with electric trucks.
What did they say, like 4.2 kilowatt, 4.2 miles per kilowatt hour?
I think so. I think that was the target.
Which is like Tesla and I think Hyundai is like 4.1 right now or 4.0. So 4 point something, anything above 4 is good. Efficiency numbers are
especially, if in something as big as a full-size truck, that's where you're, it's tough to get that kind of efficiency.
Yeah.
And then Jeep, Jeep, as you well know, Nicole's husband just got his Jeep Wrangler 4xe, the first plug-in Jeep in North America. by 2025, there are going to be battery electric versions of Jeeps in every product segment. So from the Renegade up to the Wagoneer, there will be electric Jeeps. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with there. You know, see how they do those.
I wonder if they'll keep the name Magneto, or if they're afraid that Marvel's going to sue them for the Wrangler because they have the Magneto concept.
Oh, that concept.
They'll probably just say keep it Wrangler, and maybe
you never know.
Just probably the Wrangler E by E. I don't know.
Depends what I haven't looked at what Marvel's actual trademark is. You know, it may only be for cartoon characters. You know, because Magneto's existed long before Marvel Comics.
I don't think Marvel owns it, because I just randomly Googled Magneto and there's very many other things with that name in it. So you would think they would have found out that if they owned the name.
If they had the IP, but they have the IP specifically for a fictional character as opposed to a fictional concept car. So, all
right. Right. Totally two different fictional things.
Okay. Any other thoughts on Stellantis and what they're doing?
I think it's kind of cool. I'm happy to see them moving more EV and having a solid plan for it.
I think that the idea that it has to be a race at this point to be first in EVs. Well, everyone lost that race. Tesla won that race. I mean, and I think we're just sort of settling into everyone like catching up with Tesla, but everyone's catching up at different areas. You know, people don't, you know, if you have a car that's EV this year, you know, you might get some new buyers, but people don't buy a new car every year. There's going to be people in 2 years who need a new car, in 3 years, in 5 years, and whatever, who are sort of transitioning out of either gas vehicles or hybrid vehicles into an EV. So you got some time, but not a lot. You know, you still want to get as many people as possible.
Yeah, I don't think it's a race to like, we have this, you don't, everybody has it. So it's really more a race to who's going to deliver one that for whatever reason is just better features, better drive, better range, faster charging, whatever. Those things start to matter, because just like, I have one, you don't, doesn't work anymore. Like, we all have one. Yeah. Everybody has one. So you got to make
yours. Stellantis already has a bunch of EVs in Europe.
Yeah.
Under the previous PSA brands, Peugeot, Citroën, DS, and Opel and Vauxhall. And they're in Europe through the first half of this year. Stellantis is actually number two in EV sales behind Volkswagen Group. Volkswagen Group is number one. Stellantis is number two. Tesla is number five. So Stellantis actually sells more EVs in Europe than Tesla does by a pretty wide margin. They're just not vehicles that we can buy here, and they're not the type of vehicles that most Americans are interested in, like the E208, you know, compact.
Well, and
hatchback,
wasn't the
like
even
that.
Here wasn't the and correct me if I've you seem wrong, but I thought that the Jeep, the Wrangler, was like the best selling plug-in hybrid in the last month or some such. It just hit some cool landmark number for June.
I think it was the best-selling plug-in hybrid. I heard somebody saying that, you know, they're getting like a 20% take rate on the 4xe for the Wrangler right now. So like 20% of all the orders for Wranglers are for the plug-in hybrid, which is pretty impressive. I mean,
it's a good car. It's a good Jeep. It's a Jeep.
Yeah.
It's good enough for the Nicole family.
It's good enough for the Nicole family. My husband has had it for exactly 48 hours and he loves it. So there you go.
Done.
That's all. Is he actually plugging it in?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is there was some confusion about when it was going to arrive, because we ordered this because we didn't have what we wanted. And it was like, it's not here. It's not here. It's not here. It's here. And my husband has not installed a level 2 charger in the house yet. So he's just plugging it in the old fashioned way. So he charges it overnight, but literally has to charge it overnight because it's essentially trickle charging. But he drove to work and got to work on almost using, like, he wasn't quite there and he knew he was going to run out of, you know, electric power. So he just stopped at the mall, got himself a coffee, charged for a little bit, got back in the car, finished driving to work. He's like playing with this. If ever there was evidence that like when you get one, suddenly getting that electric range matters, it's the last 48 hours of my husband playing with this car. Like, I got this many miles and I've only used this much gas. And yeah, so. But he does. He plugs it in.
The other day on Twitter, I saw somebody posted that a neighbor just got a 4xe, a Wrangler 4xe, and we went over to talk to him, and his neighbor didn't even know that it was a plug-in hybrid. He wasn't even aware of what it was. He just wanted a Wrangler, and that was what was available. And he bought it, you know, not even realizing it was a plug-in hybrid. And so he asked him, you know, so you're going to plug it in? He said, nah, you know, not even going to bother. It's like, why?
Why wouldn't you?
If you got it, you might as well plug it in.
Right. If you have it, like, why not use that? That seems kind of weird. Well, it's also a guy who bought a car that he didn't know was a plug-in hybrid, so I have a lot of questions there.
Maybe he's not a good...
No.
Yeah. Oh, well.
All right. Let's answer a few listener questions and wrap it up. So, first one from Surtur. I like the Maverick with the hybrid powertrain, but will I like the CVT? Are there good CVTs? Define good.
That's what I was... What's good? They're all CVTs are CVTs.
They're inherently not great.
Well, there are some that are better than others. Some of the Nissans are okay. But they're you know, some of the Nissans that are programmed to behave more like conventional transmissions, you know, they're okay. You know, because they don't really feel like CVTs. You know.
Yeah.
But you know, most of them are not particularly.
There isn't one. I don't think I can think of one. I'm like, wow, that is a great CVT. Bring it. That's fantastic. I can only think of CVTs that are less disappointing than others. Like, oh, that one's not so bad.
Yeah.
That one's actually okay. That one I don't mind. I've never walked away and been like, wow, you know, just like
they cracked the CVT code.
Yeah, I've never thought that in anyone I've ever driven. It's always just like, well, that was not as bad as it could have been.
Yeah, I've been racking my brain since seeing this question this morning, like of like what's a good CVT? And I'm just like,
Yeah, crickets. You can't think of one. Is there really
one? Maybe Ford will. I mean, Ford's been doing some pretty great things recently. Maybe they'll crack the code.
I mean, that's true. We're looking like, is there one right this second? None of us have driven the Maverick. Nobody knows what the CVT is going to be like. Maybe all three of us will get in and come out and go, oh my gosh.
They did it.
They have the perfect CVT. I'm not hoping.
Okay, set aside the question of CVT for a minute. I mean, you've both driven Ford hybrid vehicles, probably, you know, hybrid Escape and Fusions and stuff like that over the years. What did you think of driving those vehicles?
Yeah.
That's what I thought about.
I
think if they can,
but were they offensive?
They weren't offensive. They just
no. They're not horrible. Like really, a few years ago, like CVTs were just all pretty horrible, and they're collectively all getting less horrible. Like they're a little bit better and a little bit better, but I don't feel like any of them. I just give me an automatic transmission. So far, I just don't feel like the CVTs have the. They never bring the same, give you the same drive experience that an automatic is. You can tell the difference until you can't tell the difference.
Yeah,
like you can't feel it, you can't hear it. Then they're not going to be good.
I think Ford has a potential here because it is a hybrid that you can program it in a way that the hybrid powertrain kicks in, and that sort of gives you that low end torque that you get from an automatic transmission or a manual transmission that CVTs sometimes sort of drop the ball on. And if they can figure out how to make it not sound like the engine's going to explode because I...
That's the problem. They all sound like... That's exactly... I always feel like it sounds like cylinders are just going to go shooting through the hood of your car. Like things are going wrong underneath there. It just...
I think the hybrid powertrain is probably the best use of a CVT if you can figure out how to match them up in a way that recreates an automatic transmission feel.
Generally the Ford, you know, the front wheel drive Ford hybrids, you know, feel more like that. You know, that using the electric motor to fill that low end torque hole, you know, so. It doesn't have to do as much of that motorboating effect as you would with just a regular gas engine and a CVT. So it's not, you know, revving up to 4,500 RPM and sitting there while you accelerate. You know, it's using the electric motor for more of that, you know, to keep the engine running at a lower speed. And so I think it's less offensive. than most, you know. And gas and just straight gas engines with a CVT, because and it's a different kind. It's not the same as most CVTs. Most CVTs are, you know, it's a steel belt between a pair of pulleys that, you know, the pulleys themselves, the two halves of the pulley split apart and move together, the opposite, you know, to change the ratio. So one splits apart, the other moves together. So it changes the drive ratio. This, you know, on hybrids like this, it's a completely different mechanism. It's actually using planetary gears, and, you know, one of the two motors in the hybrid drive system is actually acting as a variable ground for the planetary gear. And we don't need to get into all the details, but it works in a very different way from most CVTs. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if you want an idea of what it's likely to feel like, you know, if you can find, you know, an Escape or a Fusion or a C-Max hybrid, you know, from the last few years, you know, and drive one of those, it's probably going to feel pretty much like that. So if you don't mind the way those feel, that's probably what this is going to drive like, because it's the same basic architecture.
I like to think that they'll be better, but, you know, fingers crossed that it's better than that. Just because I think Ford's been doing some pretty good stuff recently. And I believe in the likelihood that it might be better.
Yeah. Okay, I would agree with that ringing endorsement, Robbie.
A ringing endorsement that it would be cool if it was cooler.
Be cool if that could be cooler.
Come on, man. Be cool, Ford. We'll reach out to our Ford peeps and get right on it.
Next one is from Dutch Mandel, who was a longtime former editor, I think, or at least maybe managing editor at Auto Week. He asked, what's the likelihood of implementing a single plug standard for EV charging units and vehicles? How can that happen? What companies, institutions are leading the charge?
Leading the charge, but a bump.
Yeah. So... we have the right now with the DC fast charge, essentially that standard where it has the level 2 and level 3 has the two little plugs underneath. I think that's, is that what we're talking about? Like that or?
Well, I think he's talking about, you know, I'm assuming it's more along the lines of, you know, you've got the mm-hmm. Tesla connector, you've got CHAdeMO, and you've got CCS. Yeah. And CCS is, you know, you've got, it's basically the 1772 with the two extra pins.
I feel like CCS is the standard, and it's probably going to, I would think, stay the standard. Even Nissan has sort of decided, okay, we got to put CCS on our vehicles in addition to CHAdeMO, because you could only get a Leaf with CHAdeMO forever, and then you had to go find a CHAdeMO station. And there are, they mean EA has CHAdeMO, you know, plugs at their stations for those folks, but I think CCS is probably going to stay the standard and be the standard. And Tesla is an outlier because Tesla is Tesla. And, you know, even Tesla has to, like, deal with, you know, CCS in Europe. So.
Yeah. You know, here in the U.S., the only two brands that have ever used CHAdeMO are Nissan and Mitsubishi for their plug-in hybrids. And both of those are going away. You know, the Leaf is probably still going to be CHAdeMO until the current generation is replaced, but the new Aria that's coming out, that's using CCS. So, you know, basically, you know, aside from Tesla, it's going to be CCS across the board. You know, in Europe, they regulators actually mandated a standard connector. You know, they said everybody's going to use CCS. I mean, it's a slightly different variant of CCS than we have here because it has to support three-phase AC instead of the single phase like we use here. But it uses the same communication standards. And it's not like very many people drive between the U.S. and Europe. So, you know, a car that's in Europe is likely to stay there.
Stay there, probably.
Yeah. So in Europe, it's standardized because regulators said this is the standard. I don't think that's going to happen here. I mean, here, you know, most of the industry agreed on CCS, you know, except for Nissan. You know, and they're jumping on board now, unless, you know, some regulator comes forth and says everything's got to be CCS, you're probably not going to see that happen here, I don't think. Maybe at some point, you know, Tesla will just give up and, you know, adopt CCS, but I wouldn't hold my breath as long as Elon's still breathing.
Yeah, I don't see them opening up to other. I wrote an article a couple of years ago where, you know, how much money Tesla could make if they opened up their charging stations to other autos, the other automobiles, and supported CCS, because you could come into, you know, a Tesla, essentially a showroom, every time you needed to charge along the Tesla supercharging network if they had like a Model 3 and you showed up in a Chevy Bolt. But, you know, it's a lot of, you know, I talked to Tesla about it, and it really just comes down to the software. The hardware will support it as long as you put a CCS adapter on there. And it's down to the software. So Tesla has to support the software for the vehicle has to support the software to Tesla, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, and they said, oh, we'll let anyone charge on our network, but they haven't really done anything to make that a reality, because they want everyone to be using Tesla's thing. And that happening has long since passed.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the CCS standard was developed, you know, through an SAE standards committee. So, you know, a bunch of automakers and suppliers all participated in that process, developing that standard. So that's, you know, that's why everybody that participated in that is using that. Yeah. All right. Last question. Somebody named Rebecca Drives. I don't know who she is. But said she just rented a car for the first time in a while. It's a Nissan Rogue Sport. It has lane departure warning, blind spot monitoring, and emergency braking, but no push button start or remote locks. Basic infotainment. Is that the best strategy for rental cars? Keep it stripped or a chance to show tech and features?
I always think rental cars would be a great way to show new stuff, but I think the problem is that people aren't looking to play with a rental car when they're, you know, you're getting the car because you want to take it for a drive to get you someplace. Generally speaking, shorter distances, you know, you go someplace and you need to rent a car to drive around town. Or I don't know how much people would play to see all the features that, you know, if you got a really fully featured infotainment system, are you really going to look at all those things as you're just driving around visiting grandma for the weekend? You know,
I think rental cars, just default should have CarPlay or Android Auto support.
That's
all I want, because I have everything I need on my phone, and going in and being like, okay, is this something where I can talk to it? Oh, wait, I have to talk to a script. Oh, I have to do this. Oh, I have to pull over and push the buttons. And I just want to be able to plug in my phone. I think drivability and the interior, how nice the interior is, I think that's where you can really sort of like, hey, look how nice the interior of the new Nissan Rogue is, or how nice it drives. I think that's where you can sort of shine.
The interior would be huge, because we're normally driving, when we get press cars, we're generally driving higher trims. They're not giving us the base model of any kind of press car. So we're getting pretty nicely equipped cars.
Very rarely.
Interiors, yeah. All the fancy, right? And the few times that I've had to rent a car, they feel like they could be really brand new. Like no one's really driven it. They're in great shape. But it's just like, good Lord, when you look at the base trim, it does nothing to sell the car that I'm driving. Where if you had the leather seats, that might convince somebody that, hey, this is actually an all right kind of car. Like I do think they miss out on the opportunity to show what they can do when the only cars they've got are these base models that just don't look as nice inside. You know, people buy them, obviously, but that's not a great way to sell a car.
Yeah.
Well, I think the problem is, you know, people, you know, that are going on a vacation trip, you know, taking the family to Disney World or somewhere, you know, whatever, going on a trip, they're going to rent a car. They go on Travelocity or Expedia or wherever and, you know, book their flights, you know, book a rental car. It's like, okay, I need a compact crossover. You know, what's the cheapest one I can get? Oh, Avis has this Rogue Sport for, you know, $120 a day, or, you know, whatever they go for the cheapest one of the type that they, you know, the class that they need. And so if consumers want the cheapest possible rental car, the rental car companies aren't going to buy the high trim levels and rent them at those cheap rates. They're going to buy the stripped base models. Yeah. And, you know, occasionally, you know, they will have higher trim levels, but they come at a much higher price point, and most people aren't renting those cars.
But you'd wonder if they somehow did it, if an automaker said, okay, look, we're going to give you these instead of the stripped down base model. We'll give you this slightly better than that model. We'll give it to you at a price that you can still make it, you can still have the top trim and rent it out for more, but here's a middle instead of a bottom trim. Let's put that in your fleet. We'll give it to you at a cost that makes it worthwhile for you as if it was a base trim. That would that benefit the automaker that now they're, you know, if they're still able to rent those on the cheap, because they would it sell cars?
Or just make the base level better. How about that?
That works too. Yeah.
Well, and I think that is happening. You know, I mean, we talked about earlier, you know, about the Taos and, you know, some of the other, you know, entry level crossovers. You know, manufacturers are starting to put more and more of these features, you know, especially the driver assist stuff, but, you know, even things like, you know, a touchscreen with CarPlay and Android Auto support, you know, as standard equipment. You know, it might be a smaller touchscreen, might be a 7-inch instead of an 8 or 9 or 10-inch screen, but they're putting that as standard. Like the Taos is an example. The base Taos comes with a 7-inch screen. The upper trim levels gets an 8-inch, or maybe it was the Civic I was looking at. You know, but you know, they have standard driver assist. They have standard touchscreen with CarPlay and Android Auto. I mean, all the Hyundais and Kias, you know, the base models now all have that. Yeah. You know, Hondas have that on all their models. So I think, you know, as manufacturers move to making that kind of equipment standard, some of those cars are going to filter into the rental fleets. You know, it's only, you know, Nissan has sold a lot of cars into rental fleets over the last 5-7 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have continued to offer, you know, models that like the Rogue Sport, you know, base Rogue Sport, that are missing some of these features. But I think, you know, the current generation Rogue Sport, you know, that's probably going to get replaced next year because they just launched a new one in Europe. You know, you can get the Rogue Sport with push button start and with, you know, the nicer infotainment and everything. I think we'll see that in the next generation. I think the next generation, they won't have a key, you know, it'll have a touch screen. So hopefully that problem will get better. All right, I think that's all we got for this week. Any final thoughts?
Nope. None.
Not a one.
No thoughts all right. at
Nothing.
All.
I'm devoid of thought.
Then we will talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.